there has been a notion among American foreign policy leaders, the Henry Kissingers since the Second World War, that somehow they knew best, that they knew what kind of government there should be in Chile or South Vietnam or Laos or Iran or Guatemala or Brazil or any number of countries around the world. And that if people in these places were so irresponsible as to use a system like democracy to vote in the wrong people, then they, the Henry Kissingers of the world, had the right and indeed the duty to overthrow that established order.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, we journey into the past to gain perspective on the present. Since 2016, the FBI and U.S. intelligence agencies have been shaken by massive changes in leadership and internal strife. Attacks from the White House have questioned their intelligence briefings. Respected career intelligence officers have been fired or have resigned in protest. The FBI appears to be representing the president instead of the American people. In 1977, I covered the Libertarian Party's National Convention for Zodiac News Service in San Francisco. One of the keynote speakers, John D. Marks, was the former staff assistant to the director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the State Department. With Victor Marchetti, a former special assistant to the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Marks wrote the controversial 1974 book, The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence. Marks and Marchetti's book was responsible in part for the 1975 congressional investigation of intelligence agency abuses by the Senate Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations, aka the Church Committee. That landmark investigation led to substantial changes in the way the U.S. government handled its various intelligence agencies. In his speech, Marx outlines the misdeeds of the U.S. intelligence agencies in painful detail. Under various administrations, they had become tools of political power, often used against legally elected foreign governments and citizens of the United States.
Good morning. I appreciate your getting up earlier than I wanted to get up. I guess I do have the dubious honor of being one of two authors in American history to ever have a book censored by the government before publication, the other one being my co-author. It's not like there's another book. And it's a funny thing, because when we wrote that book, I mean, if you've ever written a book, I mean, when you write things, you want them to be in the final version. I mean, you don't put them in there so they can be pulled out. And we actually had an awful experience. I mean, it's something I don't recommend for any author, but after the government told us that 339 deletions had to be taken out of our book, we physically had to take them out because we were under an injunction, a federal court injunction, not to talk to our editor and our publisher about what was in the deleted material. So we literally sat up in our lawyer's office, our lawyers being the American Civil Liberties Union, without whom there would have been no book. And we sat in our lawyer's office at the ACLU with X-Acto knives, and we cut apart our manuscript. And we literally made the deletions for the government so we could have a version to give to our publisher. And I'll tell you, it's not a real high for an author to just cut up his book with a knife. And I didn't like it very much. And one of the things that was censored from the book was the first line of the first substantive chapter. And again, if you've ever written a book, when you start off a chapter, your first chapter, you want to say something that gets people to read on to the second chapter. It's called The Lead. And we had a great lead, we thought. It was a quote from Henry Kissinger. It kind of summed things up. The scene was in 1970, and it was a meeting in June of 1970 where Henry Kissinger was sitting around with the 40 Committee. The 40 Committee is that secret body within the National Security Council that decides where the CIA is going to intervene. Where are they going to overthrow a government, start a propaganda campaign, kill somebody? Kissinger chaired it as Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, and the Undersecretary of State, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the head of the CIA all sit on this 40 Committee. And indeed, I happened to see the minutes of that particular 40 Committee because at that point I was the assistant to the director of State Department Intelligence. And in the minutes were this quote from Henry Kissinger. And put it in because it summed up the whole book and the government censored it. And I'd like to tell you about it, but I'm under an injunction not to. The thing is, I suppose, luckily for all of us, the New York Times has reported what was in that first line of our book. So I'm going to quote to you from the New York Times, quoting from our book. I hope you understand the distinction. I mean, there's a federal district judge in North Alexandria, Virginia. I also hope understands the distinction. But what Henry said, and you'll excuse my calling him Henry, but all the important people call him Henry. What Henry said at that particular meeting, and you must understand, the Chilean elections are coming up in about 3 months. This is June 1970. Salvador Allende, who is a Marxist, is running as head of a leftist coalition that goes right across the spectrum of the left into the leftist, the left part of the Christian Democrats, sort of kind of from the Eugene McCarthy's on leftward, and or what he used to be. And there's Henry Kissinger, and they're discussing what to do. And Henry Kissinger says, and I quote from the New York Times version, I don't see why we need to stand by idly and watch a country go communist just because of the irresponsibility of its own people. And it's that second part, just because of the irresponsibility of its own people, which I think you will find very indicative of who the people are who do this kind of thing and where their heads are at. You see, because there has been a notion among American foreign policy leaders, the Henry Kissingers since the Second World War, that somehow they knew best, that they knew what kind of government there should be in Chile or South Vietnam or Laos or Iran or Guatemala or Brazil or any number of countries around the world. And that if people in these places were so irresponsible as to use a system like democracy to vote in the wrong people, then they, the Henry Kissingers of the world, had the right and indeed the duty to overthrow that established order. And Chile is one of the nastiest cases because it was a democratic election. A lot of Americans were very sympathetic to what was going on down there. They saw it as a new way in Latin America, a peaceful way toward changing the economic order down there, which, I mean, at least to my mind, is a very unjust economic order. And Henry saw it was a danger. It was a danger because it might infect other countries. It was a danger because it threatened ITT and other large multinational corporations. American corporate interests were very upset about what was going on. The CIA has been maintaining an order around the world for the last 30 years, which in the most part has encouraged far-right-wing groups, and I don't mean they were libertarian, because libertarians don't torture as much as some of the folks that the CIA has helped to put in power. But what the CIA has been encouraging as an arm of American foreign policy, and do not be confused that the CIA is not an arm of American foreign policy. It is. It's just the covert arm. I mean, you remember during the Vietnam days, people used to say Americans shouldn't be the policemen of the world. Well, what's happened for the last 30-odd years is America has been the policeman of the world, and the CIA has been the secret policeman of the world. The enforcer. If anybody steps out of line, they kill them or push them over or overthrow their government or give them shellfish toxin or something of that sort. I mean, it's a very nasty business. And in the pursuit of this business, what the CIA has said and has operated in the fashion is that the ends justify the means, that there is no method, no matter how despicable, dirty, underhanded, or the like, that is not acceptable, always in the name of national security. National security is the label behind which you can do anything. I mean, if you had had it as a kid, you would have had a lot of fun, probably. I mean, it's an excuse. It's a way. And I am not saying that the people who were involved in this kind of thing did not really sincerely believe they were serving the national security of the United States. They're patriotic people. They love their kids. They mow their lawns. I mean, they're reasonable. If you sit down with them in a bar, you might even find them charming. But once they got on the job, they felt that anything went. And I mean anything. You name it, they've done it. Actually, our government runs kind of something out of Dickens. It's a school for criminal activity in a place called The Farm, which is near Norfolk, Virginia, which is a CIA training camp. And they have courses for incipient operatives. And they give them one course in how to break into places and how to get into safes and open windows that are locked. And it's called Locks and Picks. And they have another course where they teach them how to open mail and how to open diplomatic patches and the like, and it's called Flaps and Seals. And that's given to employees of the United States government so they can go overseas, sometimes stay in the United States, and carry out, what is supposedly government operations. In other words, criminal activity in the name of the old U.S. government. And that brings me to what I think is my primary theme when I talk at such gatherings. I think, and I know people are going to say I'm a dangerous radical for saying this, and I understand I'm going to be criticized, but I sincerely do believe that the government should follow the law. Now, I know it would... Now, it's a dangerous proposition. It would mean they would have to change the way they've been doing things for a long time if the government followed the law. During the 60s, law and order became a code word against people like me, right? I mean, it became a code war against people who were against the war in Vietnam, who thought blacks and whites should have equal rights, who were organizing, let us say, a little bit to the left of the of Hubert Humphrey, right? I mean, who were thought that there should be some change in this society outside the Democratic Party's mainstream, you know, Richard Daley. And there were a lot of people like that. And the government started using illegal activities against these kinds of people. I mean, the CIA, the law that established the CIA says the CIA shall have no domestic security or police functions. I mean, Congress was very clear about that. They did not want the CIA running around inside the United States spying on people. And so what happened? All during the 60s and into the early 70s, the CIA had a program called Operation Chaos. They always choose wonderful names for these things. And under Operation Chaos, the CIA was following around and otherwise interfering with the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, the American Indian movement, the women's movement, and a few people on the right. The right didn't get so much of it that time around, though. Maybe next time it'll be the right's turn. But the CIA was doing it, and it was a violation of the law. It was a direct. There is no exception allowed in that law. And there are a lot of other laws, American laws, that the CIA has been violating over the years. For one instance, there's this law, you're not supposed to open the mail. I mean, there is no exception to that law for left-handed postmen on their birthday can open one letter. I mean, there aren't exceptions to that particular law. Yet the CIA, for 20-odd years, runs a mail-opening program along with the FBI where they open up, oh, hundreds of thousands of letters and are kind of surveilling millions of letters. Poor Frank Church, Senator Frank Church, writes a letter to his mommy from Moscow, and the CIA opens it up. Now, I mean, you know, national security or something like that. Indeed, it was rather interesting because James Angleton, who headed up counterintelligence at the CIA for many years, was asked before the House Intelligence Committee, the old Pike Committee, why was it that they were opening the mail? What did they expect to find? I mean, presumably the Russian spies don't communicate to each other by postcard. And Angleton said a very interesting thing, which is a commentary a bit on where the CIA mentality is. What Angleton said was, well, we always thought that the KGB thought that we didn't open the mail. And it's interesting because the whole program was based on the assumption that the KGB had a higher respect for American law than the CIA, in fact, did. I don't want to take that out to any more ridiculous, absurd conclusions, but it's interesting to see where the CIA was on that one. But they were breaking the law consistently. But compared to what the FBI was doing, they were not such big lawbreakers. The FBI, the CIA's program was extended into the thousands of Americans who were in those various movements. The FBI's got into the hundreds of thousands. I mean, there was a point in 1969 when J. Edgar Hoover ordered that a file be opened on every black student association in the United States, every, you know, Afro-American black student association at every black college, not every black college, and that individual files be opened up on all the members. So that meant there was a file on every black student in the United States. I mean, just to start with, that's what the FBI was doing. I mean, massive kinds of surveillance. And it really went across the board. Into all those kind of dissident movements of the 60s and into the 70s. But the FBI took it a step further, actually, than just pure old surveillance and infiltrators and informers and things of that sort. What the FBI did was to start a program called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO. Never want to call a thing by its name in this business, right? You kill people, it's called executive action, or terminate with extreme prejudice. I mean, they don't like... I kid you not, it's funny, except if you happen to be killed. I mean, then it's not so funny. But the COINTELPRO was a FBI program which was designed to harass and interfere with the activities of groups that J. Edgar Hoover didn't like. I mean, that's the only way to define it. Most of them were groups to the left, some of them were to the right. I'll just give you a few examples of what our noble government agents were doing. There was a Boy Scout troop in Orange, New Jersey, which had as a scoutmaster a member of the Socialist Workers Party. The FBI immediately recognized the danger of that. Leftist ways of following compasses, going down trails, things of that sort. And the FBI intervened with the Boy Scouts of America to get that Boy Scout troop disbanded. End of socialist workers' influence on Boy Scouts in Orange, New Jersey. There was an anti-war professor out at Arizona State University named Morris Starsky, late 60s, early 70s. And, I mean, you know the type. Whenever they invaded a new country, he would always go down to the local draft board and protest. And it was always embarrassing. I mean, in a place like Phoenix or Tempe, Arizona, there are not too many anti-war activists sometimes. And old Morris Starsky was always going out there and demonstrating. So the FBI sent an anonymous letter to his faculty tenure committee just when his appointment was coming up. And they made all sorts of scurrilous charges about Professor Starsky. And I can't say exactly as a result of it he was fired, but he sure didn't have his tenure renewed, and he didn't work there the next year. I mean, who knows to what effect the FBI's letter had an effect. But it was signed to concerned alumnus. And I assume when you sign that to a faculty tenure committee, at least they read your letter. There was a civil rights preacher in Mississippi, I think it's the Tougaloo area of Mississippi, the Reverend Muhammad Kenyatta he became. He didn't start off with that name. And he was active in the civil rights movement down there, said blacks should have equal rights with whites. And the FBI sent an anonymous letter to him saying that if he did not leave that part of the state of Mississippi, his life would be in danger. And I guess if you're black and you get that kind of letter in Mississippi, you leave. I mean, I think if you're white and you get that kind of letter in Mississippi, you also leave. But he left. He went to Philadelphia, where he now resides. That's a value judgment. Let's talk about some righties who got that. Ku Klux Klan got a little bit of this stuff. I mean, they're not friends any of ours, I don't think. And there was Klansmen in the Carolinas. This is an interesting case. In the Carolinas, late 60s, and a guy is really active in this local Klan, and he gets a letter from the FBI, not signed J. Edgar Hoover, but, you know, signed a concerned citizen or something of that sort. And the letter says that if he hadn't been spending so much time running around burning crosses on other people's lawns, he would realize that his wife was running around with every black dude in town. And I guess if you're in the Ku Klux Klan, that bothers you. I mean, I think that's why you're in the Ku Klux Klan, but I don't know about that. No. But in any case, this is what they were trying to do is cause divorces. Because if a guy has an unhappy marital life, he can't burn crosses quite as often, or he can't, you know, demonstrate against the war, or he can't demonstrate for civil rights, or whatever. And the FBI was into causing dissent and breaking up families and breaking up groups and. Oh, they just love to get groups mad at each other. I mean, and sometimes it got very nasty. Out in San Diego, there were the Black Panthers and the U.S. Party, which was kind of a black offshoot, radical also. And they started saying bad things about the one with the others, I mean, through informers and through letters and stuff like that. And after a while, they had the Panthers shooting at the U.S. Party, and people were being killed, I mean, literally in gun battles between the Panthers and the U.S. Party. And the special agent in charge of the San Diego office, in the middle of all this, right after a major killing, sends a letter back to Hoover saying, a cable back to Hoover saying, the program is going great, guns. We had one murder last week. And, you know, I mean, literally, and you don't have to take my word for this, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Church Committee, has documented this stuff, I mean, to the umpteenth degree. I mean, they pulled back and they pulled their punches on the CIA. They got very upset about the fact that the CIA, they might, you know, get in trouble going into the CIA stuff, the Church Committee did. But on the FBI stuff, they got mad. And they made documents, most of these documents, available. And the case that probably has attracted the most attention and perhaps has the most awful bottom line is what they were doing against Martin Luther King. Hoover just hated Martin Luther King. It was personal as well as ideological, and Hoover apparently was petrified by the idea there could be a so-called black messiah. I mean, there are FBI documents that were, liberated at Media Pennsylvania, in which Hoover talks about the fear of a black messiah, and it's clear that King is his example of what that could be. He did not want there to be black leadership in the United States that was of a certain nature, and to him, Martin Luther King was kind of over the line. I mean, to most of us, he was a moderate, but, you know, to Hoover, I think if you were black, you couldn't be a moderate. Hoover was racist. I mean, I will say that unequivocally. In any case, wherever Martin Luther King went during the 60s, the FBI went with him. They taped his hotel rooms. They followed him. They tried to discredit him with the press. They amassed quite a few of what I would call grunt and groan tapes. I mean, Martin Luther King had an active sex life, and J. Edgar Hoover taped most of it. And at various times during the 60s, those tapes were made available to newsmen in Washington to discredit Martin Luther King. Nobody ever wrote that story, but on the other hand, nobody ever wrote the story that J. Edgar Hoover had been making these tapes available, which I think is what the story was, not the fact that Martin Luther King occasionally went to bed with people. In any case, when Martin Luther King won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, Hoover sent him an anonymous letter. I don't think Hoover ever signed a letter in his whole life. But in any case, they sent him a letter which enclosed one of the tapes and said to him, in effect, that the jig was up and that if he would be exposed for what he was if he went to collect that Nobel Peace Prize, and the clear implication of the letter, if you read it, is he should commit suicide or he would be exposed. And that's the head of the FBI telling a man who's just won the Nobel Peace Prize that he should kill himself. And when I say the bottom line could be horrendous, we don't know what the FBI's role later on in these affairs is. No one knows. I mean, let us say that Hoover really had it in for Martin Luther King. Okay, that's COINTELPRO, and that's clearly a violation on the rights of all Americans. I mean, I don't remember old Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. on Sunday night ever causing divorces or getting people fired from their jobs or, in general, doing this kind of thing. I mean, that wasn't the vision that most Americans had about the FBI, and it's the vision that a lot of us have now, because it's true. I mean, it's all documented and everything else. And it's clearly a political use of the federal police power. I mean, political police are something most of us would associate with Nazi Germany, Soviet Union, places of that sort. We had it right here. If you were a dissident, you had the full might of the federal police come down on you. Sometimes it got very nasty. Sometimes it was only semi-nasty. I mean, if you were middle class and white and you had a beard, they would throw flowers at you and not be quite as tough as if you were black. If you were black, you seemed to wind up dead if you were in a leadership position. There are not too many black leaders around during the 60s. I mean, just look at that. And I don't want to put on the FBI or the federal government direct responsibility for the death, but they certainly were encouraging the climate and encouraging local police to get involved in such things. I mean, the shooting of Fred Hampton in Chicago, I mean, clearly set up by the FBI. Documents have since been released about it. And I mean, I don't know if you probably don't have any great sympathy, some of you, for Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers, but I think you could agree with me it's probably not a good idea to have the FBI setting up for death American political leaders or political dissidents. Left or right. Because unfortunately, with most of the right in this country, there's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the phrase national security. Somehow, I mean, I can't believe it. I mean, if H.E.W., most righties in this country hate H.E.W., man. They want to keep H.E.W. out of their lives, or SBA, or HUD, or Department of Transportation. But bring up FBI, and they say, hey, that's wonderful. I love it. I mean, why don't people have the same distrust for the FBI that they have for H.E.W. or other bureaucrats? And the reason is because they've somehow been convinced by Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and J. Edgar Hoover and kind of propaganda that this is the stuff that stands between us and the Russian menace. And it's just not true. I mean, that is just a lot of hooey. I mean, it just isn't so. And people should get that through their heads, and you've got to be consistent. I mean, I think until this year or late last year when one FBI inspector in New York was indicted for breaking and entering, right? I mean, only, 40 burglaries into the SWP offices or something like that. Until that point, no federal government official had ever been indicted or in any way charged with criminal activity for illegal activities against citizens, or not in any meaningful kind of way. And that, I mean, total unequal use of the law, and a terrible example to the bureaucracy. I mean, I don't know if any of you have ever been around the bureaucracy, but you find with the bureaucracy that if people understand very quickly what they get rewarded for and what they get punished for. And in the past, at least, you got rewarded for being one of the best burglars. I mean, being willing to go in and burgle the SWP or start a fight which got people killed among Black Panthers and U.S. Party and people of that sort. And what we need is a notion of official responsibility and accountability, that individuals who are in the government are accountable for their acts. And if they break the law, they're going to go to jail, and that they can be sued, and that they are not immune just because they're government officials. I mean, I know I am accountable for my acts, and if I break and enter, I will be charged with a crime, and I would just assume that the same thing be put on the FBI, the CIA, and the rest of the federal government agencies. Now, the CIA presents another kind of problem, and if my first message was that the government should obey the law, my second message will be, and this is also a very radical idea, is the government should tell the truth. And again, I'm going to be heavily criticized in certain quarters for saying such a thing. But the premise I would like to leave for you is that the CIA is an organization sitting right there in the middle of our government in which lying is commonplace. I mean, if you are a young CIA officer who is writing up an operation, one of the things you write in is the cover story. What are you going to say to people if they find out what we're doing is true to convince them it's not true? You lie. I mean, it's very simple. But in the CIA, a wonderful word for it, again, that bureaucratic desire not to call a spade a spade. Instead of saying lying, they say plausible deniability. How can we plausibly deny something is true if it's true? And you plausibly deny something to a friend of yours or in a court of law, and they put you up for perjury. And the CIA does it, and they have to, and government officials have to do it to protect the CIA. And so we've had a situation where the last five presidents of the United States have plausibly denied things about the CIA, have lied about the CIA in order to protect the CIA and its operations, and then they wonder why there's a credibility gap. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, let me just go back a little bit of presidential lying. I mean, President Eisenhower, the wonderful, benighted president of my childhood, I mean, smiling, making the world safe for democracy and everything else. And there are several examples, but the best well-known, the most well-known is the U-2 affair in 1960. I mean, American spy plane, CIA spy plane, shot down 800, 900 miles inside the Soviet Union, and President Eisenhower and the administration put out the story. It's an unarmed weather reconnaissance plane which has wandered off course. And I remember I was 17 at the time, very impressionable, and I said, "God damn Russians, they're shooting down our weather planes." Man, I mean, they're against thermometers and temperatures and clouds. I mean, it's incredible what's going on, right? And I was outraged till 2 days later, of course, President Eisenhower. Well, the Russians kind of surprised us on that one. There had been a feeling that there would be no evidence, right? It turns out there was a pilot in there named Francis Gary Powers, and there was a button he was supposed to push. And, you know, supposedly they told him that if he pushed the button, he would be ejected, and 5 seconds later, the plane would blow up, so there would be no trace. And I really don't believe that Francis Gary Powers thought there would be a five-second delay. In any case, he didn't push the button. And so the Russians had one very live pilot and one slightly damaged plane, rather damaged plane, but it was full of all this spy gear and, you know, gold rubles and suicide pills. I mean, it wasn't a weather reconnaissance plane. And the Russians made that very clear, and the Eisenhower administration had to back down, admit they had lied about it, and it canceled the summit of 1960 between Khrushchev and Eisenhower, which at the time was a major setback for detente. I mean, there have been other major setbacks over the year, but that was a major setback in the context of the times. In 1961, John Kennedy comes into office, and John Kennedy loves CIA stuff. I mean, Kennedy, especially Bobby, really hot for the idea of young men jumping out of plane with tight pants and boots, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, they really had a thing about that. And I don't want to get in again into the psychological business behind it, but the Green Berets, I mean, remember, you know, put silver wings on my son's chest. I mean, the Kennedys kind of invented that concept. I mean, the Eisenhower administration had started, but the Kennedys loved it. And this, the Green Berets, the special forces, were the operational arm, the paramilitary arm of the CIA. I mean, all those years when you thought they were in Vietnam fighting for the Pentagon, they were under the operational control of the CIA. And that was, again, the part they didn't tell us. In any case, President Kennedy got into this presidential line for the CIA rather early in his administration, about April of his first year, Bay of Pigs invasion. CIA puts together an invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, arms several thousand Cuban exiles, sends them in, American-supplied planes, money, guns, everything. And the Kennedy administration says it's a private effort of some concerned Cubans to overthrow their homeland. No U.S. government involvement. Poor Adlai Stevenson goes up to the UN and lies about it. There's some question whether he knew or whether he didn't know and what Tracy Barnes, the CIA man, had told him and everything like that. But the point is, poor old Adlai is caught in this bold-faced lie in front of the whole world. And the Kennedy administration is caught in a bold-faced lie in front of the whole world. And after it, President Kennedy admitted what had happened, took full responsibility for it, and said, "I guess it wouldn't happen again." Then LBJ comes into office in 1963 under fairly unfortunate circumstances, And he gets into the business of lying about what the CIA, or deceiving the country, what the CIA is doing in Southeast Asia. The fact that the CIA had started to bomb in Laos well before any of the Tonkin Gulf things had gone through, and the fact that the CIA had already was being used. And this is all with the permission of the president. I mean, it's direct order to the president, not the CIA as a rogue elephant, but that CIA was being used to carry out guerrilla raids against North Vietnam and the like. And indeed, in that very time in 1964, when the Tonkin Gulf incident happened, CIA Operation 34A raiding parties in that very area of the Tonkin Gulf, I mean, CIA paying mercenaries to go in and shoot up villages and blow up installations, and that's going on in physically the same part of the Tonkin Gulf where our destroyers are supposedly shot upon in an unprovoked fashion in 1964. Some of you may remember that incident because it led to the Tonkin Gulf resolution, which Nicholas Katzenbach said was a functional equivalent of a declaration of war. In other words, that was the thing that took us into the Vietnam War, and at least part of it was staged, it seems. At least, I tell you for sure, that the Johnson administration made no effort to tell Congress that it might not have been an unprovoked raid, right? It might have been a provoked raid. None of that came out. Some of it leaked to, Wayne Morris, who brought it up, and it just was squelched totally. And I am not saying in the context of 1964 that Congress might have voted any otherwise on that particular war. I mean, Congress was looking for a nice war in 1964, and if the North Vietnamese were going to be kind of hostile, we would have, I mean, most of the members probably were willing, would have gone through anyway. Maybe Senator Fulbright, who voted for the Tonkin Gulf resolution, might have not voted. It might have been 97-3 instead of 98-2. But the point is that if we're going to go to war, maybe the people in the Congress should know why and how and what caused it. I mean, that isn't an unreasonable request. Indeed, there is a part of the Constitution which says only Congress shall declare war. It does not say the CIA shall declare war. It does not say the president shall declare war secretly if he feels he cannot tell the American people. It says only Congress shall declare war. And the Founding Fathers put that in there for a reason, because they didn't want the president to do this himself. And the president has been doing it himself. And the CIA has been the instrument in which you could use to fight a secret war. In Laos, for 8 years, they fought a war that Congress didn't even know was being fought, so Congress couldn't cut it off. They wouldn't have anyway, but they didn't know it was happening. In any case, we're in presidential lying, and Lyndon Johnson did it, and then we got Richard Nixon. Well, Richard Nixon lied about most everything. It's hard to pick out your favorite Nixonian lies. But, I mean, since I am talking about the CIA today, I will tell you that Richard Nixon lied about the CIA in Chile, and he lied about the CIA in Watergate. And as things get tough, you don't know what President Carter is going to do. But for the moment, let us say that probably the regular systematic intervention of the CIA overseas has been cut down. It is probably not as heavy as it was. But what remains is the network, because they're all out there. All the spooks are still out there. You look in every American embassy in the world, and you find that 25% of the so-called State Department personnel are still CIA people. And they're still out there merrily recruiting to be their agents, you know, the foreign minister and the local reporters and the generals and the student leaders and the trade union leaders. And George Meany, the AFL-CIO, still allow all their international or most of their international programs to be used by the CIA. You could call it the AFL-CIA as far as its international programs go. The Church Committee would not look into that. I mean, you can kid me looking into George Meany in an election year when Frank Church wanted to be president. I mean, remember the Frank Church boomlet, right? Well, one of the effects of that, and there are other, it's more complex than that, but one of the effects, side effects of that is that the Church Committee didn't go into CIA's relationships with labor, CIA's relationships with business, deeply into CIA's relationships with the American press. I mean, you can't attack CBS and still want to be president, can you? And CBS had a systematic arrangement with the CIA during the 50s and probably into the 60s of allowing their facilities to be used for whatever CIA damn well wanted to use them for. But the point is that the fact that there is an institutional curb on the CIA inside the Congress does have some effect. And probably, I'm probably sloughing over a little bit too much what the Oversight Committee could do and is doing. They probably do have some effect. In any case, it is not a good season to be caught. So the CIA has moved into some other ways of doing some of the same things. There's always a vacuum will be filled. One thing that's going on is that foreign secret services are doing a lot more of the action at this point. You see, the CIA is not the cause of these things. It's a symptom. It's a symptom of American foreign policy as it's developed over the last 30 years. It's not the root cause. So when the CIA is knocked back, other people kind of spring up, replace it. CIA has started to use during the 60s, and now they're more on their own, the secret services of other countries to establish the same ends. In Miami, you have a situation now with Cuban terrorists. You may wonder who those Cuban terrorists are. Well, there are terrorists. We trained them. Those are the same people who did the Bay of Pigs, and they did the, you know, that secret war against Castro that went on through the 60s. And literally, our government trained thousands of people, thousands of Cubans, to be terrorists. I mean, to blow up buildings, to sabotage factories, to smuggle arms, to jump out of airplanes, that kind of stuff. Except we didn't call them terrorists. I mean, terrorism is what other people do to you. What you do to other people is called national security. Right? And these are the national security forces. But the trouble is that the CIA isn't into this game anymore, or not in a major fashion. U.S. government no longer sending in guerrillas against Fidel trying to poison his milkshake and stuff like that. You know, supposedly they don't work with the mafia anymore. And so what happened? There are a couple of thousand unemployed Cuban terrorists down in Miami, and a fair percentage of them are going freelance. And, you know, Watergate, remember, where'd they come from? Who trained them? You can go down to Miami now with a couple hundred dollars and put together a team for anything, on any side. A couple thousand dollars, probably. A lot of drugs coming into this country. You know, if you could smuggle arms into Cuba, you can smuggle drugs into the United States. And you ask the Miami police who runs the drug traffic down there in Cuba, in the Florida, in that area of the country, and you'll find there are a lot of Cubans who had agency connections. La Compañía, right? The company. Well, a lot of them also do terrorism. There was a Cuban plane blown up, 73 people killed. About in October, there was an ambassador killed, a friend of mine, Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C., apparently killed by Cubans on the request of the Chilean Secret Service, the DINA. These people are very heavy. CBS News, Bill Moyers, did a special on them about 3 weeks ago, which I think was the best thing I'd ever seen on television. It was absolutely fabulous. But what it showed is these are our terrorists, we're responsible for them, and what it didn't say is what we can do about them. And what we got to do about them is turn some of that power of the federal government against them. I mean, I'll tell you, terrorism is a very bad thing. I mean, you have 10 bombings in airports in this country, and you're going to find you're going to have martial law. I mean, the greatest, one of the greatest threats to civil liberties in the United States is terrorism, because people are very upset about the idea of getting blown up or killed by terrorists, and they do not want to be hijacked. And I'll tell you, our government was in it for a long time, and I think they're getting out of it at this point. I mean, it was okay as long as we did it to the WOGs in faraway countries, but the fact that people started doing it to us in this country, you know, it's incredible. For years, CIA is encouraging Cubans to hijack planes to the United States. I mean, and they'd come to Miami, and we'd say they voted with their feet, and wasn't it fabulous what they've done? They've escaped the hated Castro tyranny with their plane or their boat or whatever. So what happens? Americans start hijacking planes to Cuba, and it becomes a national tragedy, and suddenly we're very anti-hijacking. I mean, a sport that we helped to perfect. I mean, we didn't invent it, but we helped to perfect it as a government. But so anyway, let's forget the past for a second. There are all these terrorists running around Miami, and the government's got to do something about it. And they've got this great technique and technology, and they have all these international contacts they got from the years of spooking. And they're tough, and we need a special federal government effort to do something about it, and they're not doing it. The CIA knows who these folks are. They work with them over the years. According to Bill Moyers, at least some ex-CIA case officers continue to advise them, and our government's letting it happen. And on that CBS show, it was incredible. A masked man got up. No, he wasn't masked. There were masked men on it, but leader of the Cuban exile brigade got up, and he said, in essence, that if anybody tries to stop us, we'll kill them. And it seemed to me, since they were he said that in Miami, right? And I mean, that was a threat to the U.S. government. And incredibly, the Carter administration has done nothing about this. Incredibly, they haven't said, we accept your challenge, we're going to put you all in jail, and you can't use Miami, and you can't blow up planes, and you can't kill people in Miami. And the Carter administration hasn't said any of this. And they're afraid. The agency doesn't want any part of it. The Cubans have more on the agency than the agency has on the Cubans, I assure you that. And they don't want to go up against their friends. I mean, it's an old case officer turning in his agents. I mean, that goes against the whole clandestine creed. And so it's a major problem, and there are going to be a lot more people killed before the government does something about it. The mafia. I mean, we all know that the CIA worked together with the mafia in trying to kill Castro. One side effect of that was those mafioso who worked with the agency had, in effect, immunity from federal law enforcement during the following years. They also were in a position where they could blackmail, among others, the President of the United States. Remember, old Sam Giancana was sharing a girlfriend with JFK, and that's grounds for blackmail. right? I mean, even old J. Edgar Hoover got involved with that game, because when Hoover found out about it in 62 or 63, he immediately made an appointment with the president, went up and said, "Mr. President, I have to warn you that this woman who's been coming to the White House is also tight with Sam Giancana." Well, after that, it would have been real tough for President Kennedy to fire J. Edgar Hoover, seems to me, right? And that's the way Hoover operated. I mean, he used those files in terms of personal blackmail. When Nixon wanted to fire him in 1969 or 70 it would have been, or 71, Hoover went to the White House and made very clear to Nixon that if he was fired, the fact that Nixon had been tapping newsmen and his aides would be coming out. Nixon did not fire J. Edgar Hoover. Government by blackmail. I would have to say that the difference between totalitarian fascism and, say, the Soviet Union is not very great. Right? I mean, you're talking about essentially the same kind of thing. I would say where individual rights are repressed, where terror and repression are used as instruments of policy against their own people. And I think that the thing that really is bad, what's going on down in Latin America, is that they're doing coercive economic stuff on people, too. I mean, in Chile, under the Allende regime, there started to be a redistribution of the way the society was organized in terms of wealth. I mean, that was, you know, most Latin American societies have a very few people who own most everything and a lot of very poor people. I mean, it's not exactly the same as this country. And what they're doing down in Chile today is increasing the share of the wealth that those very few have and taking it away from the very many, which I see as repressive, right-wing, Milton Friedman at its worst, at its craziness. I mean, there may be some other places where Milton Friedman works differently, but in Chile it's being used as an instrument of repression against the Chilean people. And I think it was a disgrace that Milton Friedman was given a Nobel Peace Prize, considering his direct role in what's going on down there in Chile. And I think this is where I would leave some of you in my analysis of events. But a far-right dictatorship and a far-left dictatorship are not very different if you're in prison.
Thank you very much.
Philosopher and author George Santayana warned, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Seems George was not exaggerating. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.